full policy. To do so, he cited Roberts' report, as well as the assertion that social, economic, and political conditions had prevented the Japanese from assimilating as an integral part of the white population. But for Stone, who had in 1939 proposed special scrutiny of laws targeting discrete and insular minorities, that was not the end of the matter. Upholding what was obviously a racially based measure, Stone insisted that distinctions between citizens solely because of their ancestry are, by their very nature, odious to a free people, whose institutions are founded upon the doctrine of equality. This inspiring message demanded that Stone offer some explanation of why this particular discriminatory action was constitutional. His answer was that racial discrimination was ordinarily prohibited because race was, in most circumstances, irrelevant. By contrast, in the case of Japanese-American loyalty, Japanese origin was relevant. The danger of espionage and sabotage in time of war and of threatened invasion calls upon the military authorities to scrutinize every relevant fact bearing on the loyalty of populations in the danger areas. This discrimination based on race was therefore permissible under the Constitution. It is easy to condemn Stone for saying that racial discrimination was allowed under these circumstances. Justice Frank Murphy was sufficiently upset that he drafted a dissent, which he later changed into a concurrence, warning of the great danger of having one law for the majority of our citizens and another for those of a particular racial heritage. As the court's only Catholic, Murphy was particularly troubled by Stone's suggestion that Japanese Americans had not successfully assimilated, a recurrent Protestant accusation about Catholics in the 19th and even into the 20th century. Murphy even went so far as to compare the curfew, and by implication the internment, to the treatment accorded to members of the Jewish race in Germany and in other parts of Europe. Yet Stone could have tried to avoid the question of racial discrimination altogether. His invocation of the principle of equality remained on the books alongside his situational justification of discriminatory treatment. Eventually, it paved the way to judicial rejection of segregation. The politics of the curfew were particularly important to Douglas, who, like Murphy, wrote a separate concurrence. As the court's Westerner and as a potential presidential or vice presidential candidate, Douglas was well aware of the strong West Coast political support for the internment program. In the first half of his concurrence, which Murphy considered to be addressed to the mob, Douglas offered a justification for the Army's initial judgment. After Pearl Harbor, he wrote, "The threat of Japanese invasion of the West Coast was not fanciful but real. If the military were right in their belief that among citizens of Japanese ancestry there was an actual or incipient fifth column, we were indeed faced with the imminent threat of a dire emergency." This sounded like a full-throated defense of universal internment, but it was not. At the same time as he showed sympathy for anti-Japanese sentiment, Douglas also expressed outrage that loyal Japanese Americans were being interned. He wanted the military to institute a vetting process where loyal citizens would be released. "I think it's important to emphasize," he wrote, "that we are dealing here with a problem of loyalty, not assimilation. Loyalty is a matter of mind and of heart, not of race. That indeed is the history of America." Under the cover of support for the military's decision, Douglas was looking for a real-world solution to put an end to the internment. In the first draft of his concurrence, he all but invited interned Japanese Americans to file petitions for habeas corpus so that they could be freed individually upon acknowledgement of their loyalty. Although Douglas drew back from holding out such an unfulfillable promise, the idea would remain with him. "Guilt," he wrote, "is personal under our constitutional system. Detention for reasonable cause is one thing. Detention on account of ancestry is another." Chapter 26, A Disaster. In the spring of 1943, when the justices approved the curfew, the war was going badly in Europe and the Pacific. By the fall of 1944, when they considered the constitutionality of the removal and detention in the infamous case of Korematsu versus United States, the D-Day invasion had already produced decisive momentum to win the war in Europe. The tide had turned as well in the war against Japan. although people close to him knew his health was failing. Roosevelt was poised for re-election to a fourth term of office. Under the circumstances, the pressures to maintain unity that had prevailed the previous year were now sharply reduced. The court was still sufficiently loyal to Roosevelt that it did not want to issue an embarrassing judgment before the election. But beyond this concession, the impulse to maintain a common front in wartime was gone. This time, Justices Murphy and Roberts spoke out sharply in criticism of the internment policy, and Justices Jackson and Frankfurter gave the public a glimpse of a violent disagreement about whether the administration was adhering to the rule of law at all. In all, the decision generated 5 separate opinions from the 9 justices. Named for Fred Korematsu, the sometime flower grower who had tried to escape detention, the Korematsu decision is widely considered one of the 2 or 3 worst in American history. It was also one of the most important. The decision upheld the internment. Any law limiting the rights of a single racial group, wrote Hugo Black for the majority, is immediately suspect, and must be subjected by the courts to the most rigid scrutiny to ascertain that it is not based on racial antagonism. But, Black insisted, the exclusion of Japanese Americans from the West Coast was not based on racial prejudice. It occurred because the properly constituted military authorities feared an invasion of our West Coast and felt constrained to take proper security measures. There was evidence of disloyalty on the part of some. The military authorities considered that the need for action was great, and time was short. As a result, Black concluded, the government's action was not unconstitutional. The real issue here was not race prejudice, but loyalty. Understanding the opinion in terms of loyalty rather than prejudice explains how Black could have written it, and how Frankfurter, Douglas, Stone, Reed, and Rutledge could have joined it without sensing that it was fundamentally shameful. One key to the justices' mindset was Black's demand that any law singling out members of one race demanded strict judicial scrutiny. This proposition later became one of the founding principles of the constitutional law of discrimination. The court had never said it before, or indeed anything remotely like it. In order to shift the issue from prejudice to loyalty, Black, the former Klansman, not only condemned racial prejudice, he also declared a judicial duty to ferret it out wherever it might be found. On some level, Black must have understood that the internment of Japanese Americans was motivated by the very race prejudice he was condemning. Consider his own description of what he claimed the case was not about. Our task would be simple, our duty clear, were this a case involving the imprisonment of a loyal citizen in a concentration camp because of racial